Okay, I think we'll get proceedings underway. My name's Julie Devil-Jack. I'm a Deputy Director of the Casson Centre and Associate Professor at the Faculty of Law of Monash University. I'd like to start the evening by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I'm pleased to welcome you to tonight's event entitled Prisoners and Human Rights, the Potential and the Reality. Before I go any further, I want to mention that the Casson Centre will be tweeting tonight. So if you're interested in following along on Twitter, the hashtag is #CCPrisoners. And you'll see it up on the walls in case you forget it during the evening. And Debbie's particularly asked me to tell you all that she's not being rude and texting a mate. She's actually Twittering or tweeting, whatever the adjective is, throughout. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first speaker. We're going to go in order of Bronwyn, then Kim, and then Debbie. Dr. Bronwyn Lowry is an Associate Professor of the Law Faculty at Monash University, and she's been teaching, researching and publishing in criminal law, corrections, regulation and criminal justice and gender for over 20 years. She's currently the lead chief investigator on an ARC grant entitled Human Rights in Closed Environments, which includes prisons and other areas of detention. And she's recently become a council member for the Victorian Association for the Care and Resettlement of Offenders. I welcome Bronwyn to the lectern.
Thank you. It's great to see everyone here. It's going to be a terrific night. So the speaker shouldn't say that, but anyway, it's going to be a great night. Okay, well, as a little bit of an introduction, I'm going to just mention a couple of background matters, which I'm sure will be very familiar to all of you. Australia has, as we know, in recent years, been increasing its use of imprisonment as punishment. We know we have increasing prison populations throughout the Australian jurisdictions, and this is despite the fact that we have national and international evidence that imprisonment damages people who obviously will in most cases return to the community. Imprisonment tends to be criminogenic, meaning it increases the likelihood of people returning to prison, and it has little deterrent effect. So all the evidence suggests that you should be not using imprisonment, and all the political pressure is going the other way. So we're very conscious of the fact that there has been increasing and continues to be increasing use of imprisonment as a punishment in recent times. So it's also clear, and I hope it follows from that, that the decision to use imprisonment as a punishment is a political choice by governments. Okay, so across the world, the increases in uses of imprisonment have no correlation with changes in crime rates. So, for example, in Victoria, crime rates have been dropping for some time and levels of imprisonment are rising and continue to rise. So in my presentation, I'm going to begin from that current picture of continuing and indeed increasing use of imprisonment and address the question, what is the scope for protecting human rights in prison, the human rights of people in prison, including rights to dignity and respect, and to protection from cruel and degrading treatment? That's the question. And as Julie mentioned, I've been working for some time on an ARC-funded project on the scope for implementing human rights in a range of closed environments, immigration detention, forensic psychiatric facilities, and others. And of course, what I'm going to focus on tonight is the research that we've been carrying out into prisons. And as part of that research, we've interviewed people in prisons and other closed environments. We've talked to staff and management about rights, what they see as rights, what they see as the potential for implementing and taking account of rights when they're running a closed environment, given that all the fundamental agenda of all these closed environments is detention. It is detaining people and holding them securely in a place that they don't wish to be. Yeah? So we're saying, how do you actually do that? How do you actually do human rights in such a place? So what I want to do tonight is to outline some legal sources of rights. I'll be noting the views of some of our prisoner participants on those, to look at what's needed and what's legally possible. And then I'm going to also look very briefly at some of the other elements that one might need to actually achieve implementation of rights in a prison. So I think as a start, I'm going to come back to that, we need to be rethinking the routine use of imprisonment as a penalty. And that's one of the matters that I want to come back to, and I suspect for the other speakers may address this as well. We're really aware that there are many categories of offender who do not need to be punished by loss of liberty, and prisons of course are hugely costly as a form of punishment. But given the existence of prisons, what is the scope for establishing protections to rights and to dignity? So I want to start from a sort of a principled framework that allows us to have this discussion. So it's kind of what I would see, what I'd present as the official agreed framework that provides a good basis for discussing the scope for thinking about rights in the context of prisons, which otherwise might be seen as being an oxymoron. So as a starting point, I think we can say that the official discourse now in Australia and elsewhere is that a person is imprisoned as punishment, but seen as being a form of punishment, and then they're not imprisoned for punishment. Okay, so that the actual notion, the actual being detained, is not supposed to be further punitive. That's the official discourse. So a component of that rhetoric then is that a person only loses those rights, which you lose inevitably by being detained. So you lose a right to liberty, but you shouldn't be losing other rights unless that's essential for the loss of liberty. And we could ask questions about what that actually means. You know, can you be imprisoned and punished with loss of liberty and not have all your rights reduced? But I think as far as an official discourse goes, this is quite clearly the statement. It's a statement in our legislation. It's the assumption by people running correction systems that you only lose those rights you must lose, and logically you retain all your other rights. So I think that's a really important starting point. So in Victoria, there are two main sources of rights for prisoners. We have the Corrections Act, which specifies various rights in Section 47, rights to amount of time out of cell, rights to education, to adequate food and clothing, to reasonable medical care, and also says that these rights are in addition to any others that a person holds already. So there's a clear assumption there that people have even more rights than the ones set out in Section 47. Now, the Corrections Act was passed in 1986, so it's quite in advance for its time at that time, but a lot of things in the rights area have developed since 86, and in particular, we can also say that there's been a much greater adoption of international human rights instruments across the world and nationally since that time. Victoria, as you're probably aware, is one of only two jurisdictions in Australia that has actually passed human rights legislation. So Victoria has the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, which was passed in 2006. And the Victorian Charter, as I'll refer to it, broadly reflects the rights that are spelled out in the United Nations, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR, which are, for example, rights to life, to equality, to protection from cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment, rights to privacy, rights to protection of family, and so on. So we have these sources of rights, but what I want to come on to there is to look at what this means in practice for a person who's held in a Victorian prison. And what we found when we were interviewing people in prisons in Victoria was that they were very clear on what a rights discourse meant when you're talking about prisons. First of all, they were aware that rights are not unlimited. There's always going to be a balance going on. They're also aware, one way or another, that you can't actually do much about breaches of rights, that rights are not enforceable in Victoria. So just looking at each of those in a bit more detail. When we interviewed people in prisons in Victoria and WA about rights, they were, I have to say, deeply sceptical about our project, and they clearly felt they were humouring us by giving us time of day to talk about rights and roll their eyes and so on, but they were very polite to us and gave us lots of ideas. So they were very aware, and we can see that it's spelled out there in the Corrections Act, for example, and in the Charter, that rights are not unlimited. Rights can always be limited. That rights are going to be subject to the overriding requirement for the protection of security and good order, as spelled out in the Corrections Act. And similarly in the Charter, we have quite a broad limitation in Section 7, subsection 2, that says that rights can be subject to such reasonable limits as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society, and then list a number of factors that can be taken into account when a government or other agency is going to argue that a particular right has to be cut back or limited. So it means that in most situations, if you want to raise an issue about a violation of rights, your debate will be first of all whether the right applies at all, or whether it's been overridden by these other requirements, by the requirements of security, etc. The other key limitation there in terms of rights is that rights in Victoria are not directly enforceable. Statements of rights are only as good as their methods of enforcement, really. And this was, again, a point that was rather wryly reinforced by a lot of our interviewees. So in terms of the Victorian Charter, there's no enforcement mechanisms at all under the Corrections Act. There's no direct enforcement mechanisms under the Charter. I just note that it's not completely, it doesn't just sit there as a sort of aspirational statement. There are the requirements that public authorities comply with the Charter, and that applies to both private and public prison management. And it does trigger, has triggered internal policies and change to ensure compliance. So there was a major whole of government review once the Charter came through of all legislation, regulations, policies, protocols and so on to make them consistent with the Charter. And that certainly occurred, but if there's been a breach of any of those rights, there's not any specific capacity to bring an action to enforce that right. So breaches can only be raised in litigation if they come in conjunction with some other substantive matter that's being raised. Now, that seems to have really been raised that much already, and I do wonder whether, and I'm happy to be corrected on this, whether they're really, whether the Charter is really part of the way in which lawyers think about these issues so far. There's been a bit of time to think about it, but I'm not sure that the Charter's being used as much as it could. But the only way in which the Charter really works at the moment is that it can influence how other rights are addressed in court. I've just got a note there about a couple of cases. So, for example, this is a sort of a one-off case. In Victoria, there's a right under Section 47 to have access to reasonable medical care and treatment if you're in a prison. And in a case that came before the Supreme Court a year or two ago, a woman prisoner wanted to access IVF treatment because she was not going to be... Thank you. She was not going to be able to access that once she left the prison because of her age. And in that case, the court ultimately said that the right under Section 47 to access medical treatment read with Section 22 of the Charter, which requires humane treatment in prison, meant that she could indeed have access to her IVF treatment. So while she couldn't use the Charter as a primary sort of source of a right, you could add it into your existing right, which was what was done successfully in that case. Some specific rights then that are relevant if we're looking at the prison context. There's quite a lot, as I've mentioned, and they do reflect the ICCPR rights. The ones I wanted to note particularly were the prohibition on torture and cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment, that's the ICCPR framing of it, and parallel to that, the sort of positive obligation under Section 22 to treat people in detention with humanity and respect, and there are others here that I've noted. A central theme in the interviews and focus groups that we were running with people in prisons, I think, came down to distress about the lack of respect, about not being treated with respect, or about feeling they're being treated with contempt. And it was framed in a whole range of ways. They didn't necessarily call it, refer to Charter Section 10 or Charter Section 22, and they didn't necessarily refer to it as lack of respect, but they talked about that sense of not being treated like a human being, not being treated as someone who was worthy of respect. And it came through really strongly in the themes. And I guess there's a question of whether that is enough to come within something that's referred to under Section 10 of the Charter. And I just note here a quote from Alison Liebling, who writes a lot in the area of prisons, moral quality, standards and so on, that the idea that it's fundamentally painful, it's fundamentally damaging to be subject to contempt, to be not given respect as a human being. And I guess that I just found that a really helpful framing of that issue. It's not just saying, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, cool, why wasn't anyone being nice to me? It's actually, don't tell anyone I'm saying something. It's actually much more significant than that. It's really fundamental in terms of that idea of the person in prison as being a person with equal entitlement to be considered as a human being in the context of the work of the life that they've got in the prison. So, a couple of matters that were raised, well, I'm already running out of time, so I'll move to them quickly. A couple of issues that were raised specifically, which I'm going to come back to and try and frame within some of these Charter rights. One was the consequences of overcrowding. We'd be aware that prison overcrowding is a growing issue throughout Australia.
in some jurisdictions more than others, but Victoria certainly is currently subject to overcrowding, and this was a matter that was raised by a number of our interviewees. Another matter that was raised by quite a few of the interviewees based in Melbourne was the specific issues of the continuing inhumane conditions of the Melbourne Custody Centre, which is sort of an underground basement sort of area with no fresh air, no daylight, and you've got some quotes there from the people when they were talking about, the people we were talking to about the use of the Melbourne Custody Centre, and it's been the subject of much criticism, as you can see from that quote in 2006. So we had this issue about how do we frame this if we're going to use a human rights sort of context, and I was going to also refer there to a couple of cases in the European Court of Human Rights, which have addressed the same legislative framework, the same legislative formula, in the context of the European Court. Thank you. In the European context. So the courts there, and this is important, not because that legislation is applicable here, and not because the European Court of Human Rights operates here, but because it demonstrates to us the ways in which these sort of terms, like the terms we have in Section 8, Section 10 of the Charter, might be interpreted if we did have a right of action. I just note there that in terms of protecting rights, we do also have to think about the extent to which there's accountability, oversight, supervision of the closed environments that we're talking about. And I would note here the importance of external monitoring bodies, such as prison visitors, such as ombudsmen officers, and such as inspectorates. I also note with great optimism the very, very, very slow progress, but progress in Australia towards the final ratification of the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture, which may, if ever ratified, lead to both international and national structures of monitoring of these closed environments. Perfect. So, to conclude, thank you, George. To conclude, well, you know, can we protect human rights in prison? What are the human rights issues around imprisonment? And I'd just like to throw out just a few points here, and I hope we can have further discussion later on tonight. So first of all, I do think we really need to be challenging the routine or default use of imprisonment as a penalty. So noted prisons are enormously expensive to run. There are many other good ways to direct your money in terms of trying to address the underlying issues which might be behind people's criminal activity and which should be being taken a lot more seriously, poverty, mental illness, early childhood supports and so on. We need to challenge the exclusion and the othering of offenders in the general community, in politics, media debate and so on. A big ask really, and something to do with a much broader sort of cultural change and understanding of our notions of rights, I think, and notions of respect and notions of civility. Within prisons, I do think it's really important to be still aiming for respectful relations that are really around what I was describing earlier as having that real interpersonal respect, that sense of how would I want to be treated if I was in that position. And I think we can still work towards that. And finally, I really don't want to give up on the idea of human rights and human rights legislation as a way of trying to make change. And I would like to see us using human rights instruments more and more creatively to establish sort of parameters for acceptable behaviour and to strengthen things like resource allocation decisions in this area. Thank you. Do you all want to get a seat? There's some seats over there. We won't interrupt people now. Thank you very much, Bronwyn. That was great. I've been working on a project with Bronwyn, so I kind of know it all. On this project. Anyway. Our next speaker is Dr. Kim Tate, and she's a lawyer and teacher by training, has completed postgraduate work in forensic mental health, and was also awarded an honorary doctorate from the University of Ottawa. Kim is the executive director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, otherwise known as CAPES, I assume that's the acronym, and a part-time professor at the University of Ottawa in the law faculty. CAPES work with marginalised, victimised, criminalised and institutionalised women and girls throughout Canada. And Kim, in her long career, has also worked with youth and men. So welcome, CAPES, to the lectern now.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I've now been 24 hours in Australia, and this is the fourth talk. So for those of you who have had to be through others, I apologize for repetition. I want to start by acknowledging the traditional territory of the Wurundjeri people and the Kulin Nation. I come from stolen territory as well. I currently live in Algonquin territory, otherwise known to many of you as Ottawa, or maybe not, but it's the capital of a country known as Canada. And every day of the last 30 years that I've had the privilege and responsibility of being able to walk into, and most importantly out of, prisons for young people, for men, and for women, it's been painfully obvious the impact of colonization on our Indigenous peoples. And when I've had the privilege of also walking in, and again, more importantly, out of prisons in this country, similarly, the overrepresentation of Indigenous peoples is painfully obvious. In our country, we jail Aboriginal people at 10 times the rate we jail anybody else. And women, in particular, are jailed at more than double, and in some cases, triple and quadruple the rate at which we jail even Aboriginal men. So I want to thank also Bronwyn for organizing and the Monash for inviting me here. And I very much look forward to the discussion. Some of you who know me will know that when I heard the title, I thought the potential and reality. Well, the potential is infinite, the reality is dismal. Okay, that's the end of my talk. but truly the potential is infinite. And I come from a context in which, having trained in law, started out believing that we could use the law and we could use human rights instruments to really ensure protection of prisoners. I'm at a state now where I think there are many ways we can still argue those, but in fact we have much more likelihood of changing things by activating the entire population to see the human rights violations. We also have to ensure that prisoners understand human rights violations. Because one of the, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the projects we've done, and then I'd like to talk a bit about how in the past number of years, in particular, activating women in prison to train future lawyers and to train individuals who are working in the area has actually, I think, some of the greatest potential to ensure some recognition of the human rights violations that exist in prisons. And when I think of human rights, I think of the analysis and the description that Louise Arbour, several years ago in Canada, lecture talked about. What are we really talking about when we talk about human rights? We can talk about the international instruments, we can talk about the charters, we can talk about in our country the charter, our constitution, Human Rights Act, but what we're really talking about is freedom from want. That every person as a human right should be entitled to the same opportunities, not just to be clothed, housed, fed, educated, but to actually have freedom from want so they can actually experience what substantive equality would mean if, in fact, we really meant it to exist. And I'll come back to that. So how have we tried to do that? So very quickly, I'll speed through them, and if anybody's interested, there's more information on our website. I'm happy to send it to you electronically. I'm happy to have a bit of a discussion. When we started out, we tried to do, our organization is an abolitionist organization. We don't believe in the use of imprisonment. We envision a Canada and a world, in fact, without prisons, a world that has existed previously and could exist again. And I'm happy to have that discussion too, but so just I'm putting out all of these, so potential for the discussion period. We became abolitionists because we had embarked upon what is seen still in most international, in academic and legal circles, and in fact in criminal justice and criminology circles, as one of the most historic, progressive prison reform movements and prison reform experiments, certainly this or last century. It was actually in the 1990s. And that was the Task Force on Federally Sentenced Women, which was embarked upon in Canada. It was a partnership between prisoners, shock of shocks, prisoners were actually involved, former prisoners, the Correctional Service of Canada, and our organization and a number of other women's groups and community-based groups. And the idea was to really look at who is in prison, who is being criminalized, and what, in particular women, and what risks they pose and what alternatives could exist. the long and the short was came up with some wonderful ideas, some wonderful opportunities for change. The minute implementation started, all of the alternates besides corrections were removed from the picture, and corrections was left to implement the plan. I don't mean to sound at all cynical, but those involved in corrections, as they now will say to me, that was the first mistake. You shouldn't have let us do that. How, in fact, we were seen to have the power to stop that was a whole other issue, but that's another part of the discussion. So we then went on to see that thought start to fall flat. We started to see abuses continue in the prison system. We then had what's often referred to as the Arbour Commission. Some of you will know that Louise Arbour went on to be the UN Human Rights Commissioner for a time. She was also on our Supreme Court of Canada, renowned for being the only member of the most senior court in our country to ever have resigned the position, recognizing that, in fact, there was very little potential to change the law, even from the Supreme Court of Canada. So think again about the potential for human rights. And she made recommendations that called for external judicial oversight. She called for limits on the use of things like segregation. She called for external accountability to corrections. She even called on corrections to implement, or the Government of Canada to implement recommendations that would allow prisoners to go back to court to have their sentences revisited in a context where the correctional treatment amounted to violations of the law and therefore unlawful sentences for prisoners. And she also talked about ways to encourage correctional accountability in terms of correctional individuals. Her recommendations were not followed up, so 5 years later, we were on our way to the UN, and we were told we had to exhaust all domestic remedies. We were pretty exhausted at the time, but nevertheless, we decided we would launch a human rights complaint. And we used what then, here, Harry Alcott, they were then known, also adopted a model that our Human Rights Commission took a suggestion we made, which was to combine two sections of our legislation, one that allowed them to do a systemic review of human rights, and another to do a special report and to make recommendations about human rights violations, which they did. And they found that our correctional system for women, which is seen at the time as the most progressive in the world, was found to be discriminatory on the basis of sex, because of discriminating against women, on the basis of race, because of the overrepresentation, overclassification of racialized individuals, particularly Indigenous peoples and women, and on the basis of disability because of the overrepresentation of individuals with mental health issues. So our most progressive system in the country, and arguably in the world, was found to be discriminatory at every level under our human rights legislation. The recommendations still weren't followed, so then we proceeded on to the United Nations. The CEDAW Committee, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, the Anti-Racism, the Human Rights Committee itself under the ICCPR, under the Convention Against Torture, found that Canada had human rights violations. We still haven't seen action. So you'll pardon a bit of my cynicism about the ability of us to actually bring human rights into the prison system. So we started some new tasks. We, through inquests, through various inquiries, through appeals, through particular transfers, through the use of parole provisions. We've tried at every level to ensure that human rights interpretations and human rights analyses exist. One of the things we're in the midst of right now that poses some potential for positive change, mostly because it is educating the public, are two main areas that I wanted to share with you. One is the fact that we have a very high-profile death in custody that is being broadcast, live-streamed, in fact, as the inquest is ongoing. Because the mother of the woman who died, the girl who died, this was a young woman who was jailed for breaching probation. She was on probation for throwing crab apples, which is a little hard fruit, for those of you who don't know what a crab apple is, at a postal worker who she believed was delivering social assistance, Centrelink checks, late to families who relied on that for income. Doesn't mean it's okay, but nevertheless, would you expect a jail sentence for that? So So she was jailed for breach of probation. Before she even got to court, she accumulated charges, criminal charges, as she tried to escape custody, as she resisted strip searches, as she resisted being taken into custody. By the time she died, she had accumulated over 180 new sentences for a total cumulative sentence of over 6.5 years. She had been in youth custody. She had been in every form of restraint. She had been gassed many times. She had been forcibly injected. She had been tasered. And she, when she died, she had been in adult custody for 11 months, had been transferred 17 times right across our country, and died while under suicide watch and constant observation. That means officers posted at her cell, 5 officers watching, 3 cameras, and died with a ligature tied around her neck, and the staff saying that they had been ordered not to go in because she was just trying to get attention, and the thing to do was withdraw attention and not intervene unless she wasn't breathing. So that has led to a family who, a mother, who has said, I don't understand how my daughter could have died in that circumstance. I don't know any Canadian could have understand, and I want everybody to understand by the end of it. An incredibly courageous move for a grieving mother to say, I want every piece of this exposed. After 30 years of doing this work, there's not a whole lot that surprises me. But what has surprised me most about this process is I expected at least 1 or 2 violent outbursts to have been properly chronicled in Ashley Smith's record. And I can now tell you very safely, very confidently, there are none. That yes, she spat at officers on occasion. Yes, she resisted restraints. Yes, she swung out while restrained. And what technically would be described legally as assaults did occur. There was in no way that this young woman was a danger to anybody but herself. And yet every human rights violation that I've ever seen chronicled in a prison occurred to this young woman. And every excuse used for those human rights violations has been chronicled in her record. And just as we saw in the Nuremberg trials, and just as we saw the reason for a UN Declaration for Human Rights, the repeated description, excuse for inaction was either it was orders, people didn't know what else to do, and they had no other options. So in that context, we started to say, what do we do? So we went in and met with women. We regularly in the prisons. We have 18 advocates who go in, who are volunteers, by the way. Some of them are lawyers. Some of them are work as within our organization. But they go in as advocates on a voluntary basis. We started to work with them and with law students to go in. And one of the things that was most shocking to all of us was not just Ashley, but most women have no idea what their human rights are. They believe that staff are entitled to assault them. They believe that staff are entitled to forcibly inject. What they believe they're not entitled to do are very minor compared to what they believe the staff are entitled to do to them. And so that has been one of the most significant challenges, I think, and poses one of the most significant challenges. Not only that, most staff believe they're entitled to violate human rights. And so when we've been going into the prisons, it's been a mutual education process for law students and for prisoners as to, in fact, what human rights violations are, what human rights are and are not, and who is entitled, you know, the ability to not only to know what your rights are, but the ability to exercise your rights. And so one of the things we've been spending a fair bit of time doing is trying to figure out how to get that information out as widely and publicly available as possible. And so that our strategy has been very much to talk about what do human rights mean, what does it mean to our country to have these kinds of human rights violations happening within our prisons, and why is it important for all of us to be concerned about those practices. And the final thing that I'll say about the learning we've had in this process is, if someone had told me 30 years ago when I was starting this work, or even 35 years ago, when I was first training in some of this area, that one of the most reliable and consistent sources of information now would not just be prisoners, but would be prison staff about these human rights violations, I wouldn't have believed you. And yet, an example of just the extent to which the inability to inject human rights protections in prisons is endemic and systemic within not just Canada, but I would suggest every prison system in the world, is the fact that we now have prison staff urging us on a daily basis to bring complaints, not just human rights complaints, but court cases and actions against their own employers because they feel so impotent to actually have not just protections for prisoners, but for themselves. And so one of the challenges we have now is how do we actually ensure that not only people know what their rights are, but that they have an ability to exercise their rights. And if they can't exercise them in Canada, one of the wealthiest, supposedly human rights leaders in the world, then how on earth can we expect them to be embedded within the prisons themselves in any part of the world? And so I'll leave you with a quote that I often use. It was first provided to me by a woman who was serving a life sentence, and still was serving a life sentence, but is now in the community. She at the time was in isolation in a men's prison because no prison for women in our country wanted her. So she was in isolation in a prison for men, and her name is Gail Corey, and she first read the quote. It was a quote that she got actually from an elder here, Lilla Watson, who's in the Brisbane area, and the quote goes like this. And she said, basically she was telling me, I was asking her what I needed to do my job, and she said, just always follow this, so I'll leave it with you as well. If you've come here to help me, you're wasting our time. If you've come here because your liberation is bounded with mine, then let us work together. And I think that really is how we will see what the potential for human rights protection is, not just in prisons, but around the world. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Kim, for that depressing introduction.
I'm sorry, we're going to do a focus as well.
Our final speaker this evening, before question time, is Debbie Kilroy. She has a very long list of letters behind her name, including a Bachelor of Laws, a Bachelor of Social Work, a grad dip in forensic mental health, so I'm reading it as I go, and a grad dip in legal practice. And she's also a former prisoner. Before I move on from there, she also has an Order of Australia medal. Debbie is the CEO of Sisters Inside, which is an independent community organisation which advocates the human rights of criminalised women. Debbie is a strong and passionate advocate for the implementation and monitoring of human rights in prisons. She's participated in several international meetings on this topic, and she has also recently been awarded a prestigious Churchill Fellowship to study decarceration around the world. Debbie is the first person convicted of a serious criminal offence who has been admitted to practice law, and her expertise is criminal defence law. I welcome Debbie to the lectern.
Hi everyone, and thanks for coming tonight. Before I do start to speak, I do want to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and the land that we meet here tonight is Aboriginal land, always has been, always will be, and it's such a beautiful place here in Melbourne. And I'd like to encourage all of you here that are not Indigenous people to keep in the forefront of your mind that we are on Aboriginal land and to walk with great respect on this beautiful country. I reside on stolen Ngunnawal land, which is south of Brisbane, and works its way out towards Stradbroke Island. I'd like to acknowledge elders past and present, and also any Aboriginal people here tonight. Going to prison on a daily basis, we see the stark reality of colonisation in this country, and that is seeing a massive over-representation of Aboriginal people in our prisons. And this is the impact of colonisation in this country. And we need to take a look at that. When we know in the last decade there's been an increase of Aboriginal women's population in this country in the last 10 years, it's 56.8%, which is absolutely mind-blowing. And when we look at then, it's Aboriginal men, around 33%, other non-Indigenous women, around 22%, and then non-Indigenous men, who can actually guess what the increase has been in the last 10 years for non-Indigenous men? Anyone? It's around 3%. So what we're seeing here is a fundamentally racist, sexist system that targets Aboriginal women and Aboriginal men. And we actually need to unpack those structures ourselves and the racism and address that so we actually stop incarcerating the most disadvantaged people in our communities, particularly women and particularly Aboriginal women. I just want to thank Bronwyn as well and the Caston Human Rights Centre for the invitation tonight. And before I move on, I'd also want us to think about those women that are incarcerated, not only in this country but around the world. It's now, nearly 7:15 at night. So in most prisons across this country, women will be in lockdown now in their cells. And most prisons, women are locked down for about 12 hours, if not up to 16 hours, unless you're in isolation, which will be 24 hours of the clock and maybe a one-hour release under legislation and to comply with so-called human rights legislation. I want us to think about how we've made choices today to come here and how this morning when we woke up, we made choices about what we wanted to do, whether it's to go buy a cup of coffee, hug our children, drop our children to school, go to work, not go to work, sit around in a cafe, chat with friends, engage. The choices that you make just on a daily basis, where women are awoken at 6 o'clock in the morning, released at about 7 a.m, and visits may start at about 9 o'clock in the morning if they're lucky enough that family have the resources to actually be able to transport themselves to the women's prisons that are usually on the outskirts of the cities where there is no transport usually. And it's usually the extended family of the women, the grandmothers, who are raising those children and trying to get them to the prison for those visits. And I suppose I want you to think about the price that the women have paid today that have had contact with their children and their families. And I see this, and we see this fundamentally as cruel, inhumane and degrading treatment and torture, and that is where we have dignified strip searches. Now, I'm not sure if anyone knows what a dignified strip search is. A dignified strip search is where I take the top half of my clothes off, all of them, and give them to the prison officer. I'll flick my hair, spin around, flick my hair, open my mouth, flick my tongue, raise my boobs, and then they'll give me back my bra. Then I remove the bottom half of my clothes and hand them over, and if I'm lucky enough, that's as far as that will go, but most women aren't that lucky, and they get even further dignified search, where they may have to squat and cough, or even squat and cough over a mirror, remove their tampon or their pad, and give that to the prison officer. So this is a dignified strip search. Actually, we see it nothing more than state sexual assault. It's sexual assault sanctioned by the state, and we as a community allow this to happen. Now, under the guise of policy and the rhetoric and the marketing of a big multi-billion dollar system, the prison system, that it's actually to stop contraband coming into prison. Well, when the Brisbane Women's Prison now, that's opened in 1999, they used to record handwritten records around the number of strip searches that were undertaken in that prison and contraband found. So there's about 42,500 strip searches that occurred over a period of time, and there was basically only two pieces of contraband found. One was a white pill that was never analysed, and we don't know what it was, but it was recorded, and the other was a foul odour. I still don't know how you can find a foul odour, but that's what's recorded. So we need to think about the abuses that are being perpetrated against women inside a prison system that's actually built under the guise of community safety to ensure you are all safe in your community, when we know it actually doesn't create safety for us at all. It actually is very unsafe for women. And I don't know if people saw yesterday when a prison employee of that Brisbane Women's Prison was charged with over 29 offences, 3 rapes of women inside prison, 16 sexual assaults, and 11 abuses of power, and there's more charges to come. And this has been occurring since 2005. And I know that today Ben from the Human Rights Law Centre and ourselves have done a bit of media around that, and hopefully that will be on ABC at some stage, calling for an independent prison inspector, so that women can raise complaints that are separate from the system. Because at the moment in our system, we have an inspector of prisons. However, they're a bureaucrat with inside corrective services. So it's corrective services investigating corrective services. So, for example, there's been a number of women over the years in that particular prison and Townsville Women's Prison, where there's predominantly Aboriginal women, have complained about being raped. The inspector's unit will investigate that, and usually there's not enough evidence that's been found and no charges are laid. So this is actually the first time that charges have been laid. So obviously there's a hell of a lot of evidence, and finally they've got off their butts and actually got the evidence, and at least some women, hopefully, at the end of the day, depending on the actual criminal law process, which is always difficult for women then to come and give evidence against their rapists in court and cross-examined by defence lawyers, is going to be very difficult. And that's why we call for an independent inspector, so that prisoners can make those complaints that aren't made to the jailers that jail them. They need to be absolutely independent. So the other two areas that I just want to briefly speak about, because this is about human rights, is talk about the human rights complaint that we had lodged back in 2004, June 17th. And it was based on the complaint that Tim talked about that happened in Canada. But in Queensland, we don't have a Human Rights Act, so we had to lodge a complaint at the Anti-Discrimination Commission, where there was sections in the legislation there that allowed the Anti-Discrimination Commissioner to undertake a systemic review, where she, at that time was a she, Susan Booth, deemed fit. And she did investigate, they did investigate and released a report in 2006. But one thing we know in the work that we do in relation to prisons and raising the issues of discrimination and human rights breaches is a lot of times you don't get much kick from the prison. They just power on because they're a huge, powerful industry. But when we did lodge this complaint in June 17, 2004, we were called to the Minister's Office in Parliament House and were automatically locked out within about 5 hours. So we knew we had it right. And it kicked back big time. And it's always good to get a kick back from the prison system because you know that you actually have hit the underbelly and you might actually get something, you know, moving in relation to that and exposing that into, you know, for the community. Because the reality is there's lots of stories that you would never be exposed to or hear, because the system has an abundance of laws that actually cover it up. And it's not about lack of laws, it's actually the abundance of laws that makes it very difficult to expose what's happening inside a prison system. Anyway, so within, so our services were locked out, we were all locked out, and we had to renegotiate our services and only allowed some services to go back into the prison. And then on April Fool's Day 2005, my biography was released, and then I was automatically banned from all Queensland prisons. And I was so for nearly 6 years. And so that was a pretty good kick. But it allowed us then to look at, gave me some time on my hands. And that was about, wasn't going into the prison, but the women, we found many other ways to communicate and stay in touch. And the reality is then we could put some legs on decarceration strategies to actually keep women out of prison, make their prison stay shorter, and keep them out when they're released. And so that allows me, and also allowed me to finish my law degree and get admitted as a lawyer, and then they had to let me back in as a lawyer because they actually can't stop me from going in as a lawyer. Anyway, at the moment, you know, prisons work in like merry-go-rounds. They go round, 1 minute you're locked out, and then at the moment it's a big red carpet at home for us, so that's okay. But it's still women languishing in prison and being a lot of violence perpetrated against them by the actual system. And I suppose the thing that we're working on at the moment, and I encourage you here in this room, and I know that you're Victorians, but it's really important. Is that about 10 minutes ago?
No, 10.
Oh, anyway.
5 ago.
Okay. we're in Victoria, and so Victoria and the ACT are the only jurisdiction in this country that has human rights legislation. At the moment, I would encourage you as Victorians who does have a Human Rights Act, just like the ACT, is to engage with the Human Rights Commission there, because the Commission is actually doing an audit of the so-called human rights prison in the ACT. And they're doing an audit in relation to their Act and the Corrections Management Act. And so they need as many submissions in relation to law and international law and frameworks to actually support the Commission in writing a report that will actually then have some meaning to those women that are in that prison. And it's interesting that women's prison, like I always, we were consulted way back before it even was started to be built, and because they were interested in our human rights complaints. And they actually believed when they flew me down to Canberra that this prison was going to be a human rights prison and it's going to be different, and all this within our submissions would never happen. Well, that's happening and worse. There's about 12 women that languish in that prison at any one time, and when I talked about the increase of women's population in this country and in the Western world, it actually hasn't happened in the ACT. There's actually about 10, 12 women at any one time. There hasn't been that massive increase. But what is different there is there's about 70-80% recidivist rate. So they've got 7 or 8 women that just cycle back and forwards into that system. Now, you can't tell me it's rocket science that we can't support those women to keep them out of prison and stop them going back in. And if we look at the framework of human rights, there's plenty of avenues of how we can do that. So I encourage you that, you know, whether you write PhDs around human rights prisons or, you know, the Law Centre, I'm sure you're doing something, Ben, but other people of interest, have a look at the SCOOP. There's only like 5 or 6 submissions on their website now around the audit. The report's not going to be released until November, and they're looking for submissions. And just because you're not, you don't live in the ACT doesn't matter. We'll be putting in a submission focusing on their legislation as well as the Bangkok rules. And because fundamentally they are breaching the law on a daily basis in relation to all prisoners in that jurisdiction. And so I encourage you to participate in that. And from that, what we're doing is because what we're seeing also is a number of human rights breaches across women's prisons in this country, and obviously men, but my work is in regards to with and for women. We're actually going to start some advocacy training and train human rights watchers, if you like. And that will be training women inside prison. That will allow the training, and ACT has agreed to that already, which is good. And the women are really keen to undertake that training, as well as women with lived prison experience that can go into prison and do the training, and also those of us in the community that have access to women's prisons. And the advocacy training will be training workers, volunteers, whoever's going into women's prisons, and those women that are in languishing those prisons to be able to identify human rights breaches. All women in prison, and it's nowhere, not different anywhere than in any other jurisdiction, women in prison actually fundamentally believe they do not have human rights. They are for other people. They are for the white middle upper class. They're actually not for us, those of us in the prison system, which is tragic. And so there has to be a whole heap of work done around that so that women inside who are criminalised in prison and in prison do understand that they do have human rights protections. And what we've got to do is to then actually expose those breaches very quickly and not have, for example, the situation in Adelaide prison where the woman was shackled to the bed for over 12 months, and it took over 12 months for that to be exposed. 14 minutes to go. Sweet. I'm joking. And so that then those workers or those volunteers, because corrective services does threaten people, and, to stop your access, and some services sign gag clause, for example, in their funding agreements. But it's a way to allow the women inside and those that actually have access to the system to be able to contact us, because we do have access to all the women's prison, and actually expose that. So that woman isn't left there for 12 months shackled in a men's prison. You know, and someone has to see that. You know, and the other thing that occurs in Darwin Women's Prison, for example, is when you go through the health centre, there's another door, but the health centre's all been renovated, and there's another open door. Well, there might be a door on it, but anyway, you walk through it, and it's still the old original stone prison, stone and rock prison, with the actual shackles, arm and leg shackles, still in the wall. And women with mental illnesses are shackled to that today still as a form of treatment. So we need to expose these human rights breaches, and you need to know that they're occurring so that you can speak out, not be silent and not be submissive, and allow these this perpetration of violence against women to occur. Okay, I'm done.
Thank you, Debbie. You're the first thing. Wow, my time's gotten longer. The longer I speak, the longer I get. It's a great way to approach it, annoying chair. Anyway, we now have about 15 minutes for questions, and we have a roving mic.
so I'm sure is start at the back there. If you wouldn't mind just saying who you are as you ask your question, use some context.
My name is Nick Golder, I'm a policy consultant and I just finished a law degree at Monash actually. My question is, in a state that is that has lost its mind over what happened to Dilma, that is publicly in the media putting pressure on the parole board to be tougher and tougher, in a state where no politician has ever gone wrong being tough on crime and probably in the present future won't be punished ever for being tough on crime, how
Well, we're living in a fascist regime right now. I never thought I'd say that. Sorry, Christian. But we are. And we cannot find a politician who will speak out, even the ones who are seen as some of the most progressive on these sorts of issues. And so, if you know, I don't know if this is helpful, but the approach that we've taken on some of these is actually to work with. So, for instance, in this context, we would work with the other women's groups, although many of them have been wiped out in Canada, but working with some of the other groups to form coalitions to actually call for different approaches and to demand that if we actually want to take serious the idea of public safety and protecting people, we need to look at fundamentally providing opportunities for those who are the least so that they're not being increasingly victimized. I'm working on right now a bill or a response to a proposed victims' bill of rights, which is exactly built on those sorts of ideas and has taken people who have had tragic, tragic experiences of losses, of usually loss of life, a family member being killed, and who are being exploited, quite frankly, and being encouraged to tap into their anger. And so we're trying their anger and frustration and their victimization. And so encouraging people to think beyond those sorts of circumstances. So I don't think there are any easy answers. I mean, we also have had people who have experienced those sorts of losses then speak out. And so those are some of the approaches we're taking and talking about really do we want the human and social and financial costs associated with more of those models. And we have the benefit of being able to point south of the border and say, if those approaches truly had been effective, not only would the states not be retreating so much from those positions, but the United States should be the safest place in the world to live, and we should all be flocking to those places. And, you know, so those are just some of the strategies. No magical answers. Certainly one of the issues with politicians is that they're in for a short period of time, and these sorts of approaches take longer time. Damage that is being done in Canada, I mean, just in the past 5 years alone, we've had a quadrupling number of
anti-terminals.
So, yeah, we're not a good one to follow right at the moment, but
okay,
those are some ideas of some of the things we're doing.
Let's talk about, and that was tragic that it occurred to Jill. But at the same time, there was a woman in St. Kilda, Tracy, who was a sex worker who was also murdered, and she didn't even create a blip on the radar. And it's about whose lives do we value more in our society? Is it the white middle-class woman that works at ABC, or is it the sex worker down the street? And the media has played out that. But I suppose what I want to say is, that shock jock, shock law and order feeding into that frenzy is never going to work and it's never going to create safety for any of us. And what's happened, because we have some lunatic right-wing regime in Queensland now, and because of what's happening down here around parole, our attorney has announced that they're going to undertake consultation, but we know what that means, and actually remove court order and parole for people in prison and suspended sentences. Well, the numbers have been crunched by a law lecturer who contacted me the other day and said it's going to cost us as taxpayers in Queensland another $48 million to do that. So it's actually put another $48 million poured down the throat of prison, and it will not change the recidivist rate at all. So, these policies actually don't create the outcome that they're sprouting in the media and what the media sprouts. It's actually creating more fear. And the reality of the horror that's happened to those two women and other women in those types of circumstances, the reality is most crimes are perpetrated under our own roof against women and children, predominantly, and that's where the rapes and the sexual assaults and the physical abuses occur, is under our own roofs, and that's never spoken about. And that's what we need to talk about as well. The stranger danger is very rare, but that's what politicians, the law and order, you know, campaign, the fear-mongering is focused on, where we actually need to say, no, wait a minute, we actually need to create homes safer. Yes, and of course, on the street safer, but I mean, it's about how we as a community want our community to be, or do we actually want to lock ourselves inside our house with bars on our windows and have no other human contact, you know, to the external world, because that's where I feel safe. I have to tell you, I don't lock my house and I don't feel safe by being behind closed doors. I've spent that much time in prison, the last place I want to be. Everyone knows my doors are open. And, do you know what I mean? So it's about... yeah, I'm an attached to my position. But that's the thing. So, you know, it's about the way you want to live, I suppose. And we have to walk our talk in relation to that and get towards that. And people will be victimised and hurt, you know. Like my friend was murdered sitting beside me in prison and, you know, I had to resolve those issues with her. If Citizen Side was truly going to be about working with and for all women, criminalised and prison women. So I had to actually approach Storm, who murdered my friend and a serving wife, and build that relationship, deal with the trauma of that murder, work through those issues, not with any legal structure or supportive corrective services. And eventually, she's now been released for 2 years, and I advocated a parole board for her release. But it's about how myself, as a victim of crime, if you like, actually resolve that within myself, because I have to resolve it in myself and not think that the punishment of the other is going to actually give me closure, because it actually won't.
Can I just get one quick comment in relation to that, if that's all right? It was just on another aspect of that point, which I think is a really important issue, this, the whole driving of a tough on crime law and on an agenda. And I would also just note that it's interesting to see that there are jurisdictions which don't get the same traction with that sort of analysis. And I'd use as an illustration the situation that occurred in Finland, where there was an active decision to reduce the prison population, a range of factors that were taken into account, a range of changes, which led to a huge reduction in the prison population in Finland, which has been one of the factors that that people who did the analysis point to, is that the whole tough on crime, law and order agenda is not a hot button issue, and that they don't have the tabloid media, sort of the crime story stuff that we just live with and assume is going to always take over. And I don't know how one changes it now. And of course, they're watching what's happening in relation to the expert and media proprietors and so on. But I do think it's a significant factor.
Hi, my name is Evan Fitzgerald. I'm with the Internet, Secretary of National. I was wondering, Deb, what for you would be a couple of the priority actions that you think would have a significant impact to reduce incarceration rates and recidivism for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women? So if you had a genie who said you've got three things that you can make happen, what do you think is most important?
So I get the prison keys to the front door of all the women's prisons in this country and open the doors. But they don't have keys anymore, so I need to press the button there. Yeah. And release all women in prison. Because the reality is going to be, if you release all women in prison, the crime rate isn't going to go up. And but it's about the money that holds them in that incarceration follows them in the community and allows them to be supported in the community. Okay? Because the cost of imprisonment of an individual woman is about $70,000 a year. And then we look at the cost of their children being removed by the state and those children in care, and sometimes are never returned to their mothers. So then we have another stolen generation of children removed from Aboriginal women. So the cost of that, not just the fiscal cost, but the human cost of that and loss of culture. So that would be, is that one thing or is that a few things? No, I think that's an extension of one. Number two, I think the release has to be the first one. So number two is a magic wand to actually So everyone in this country would understand that they've been socialised to be racist, and to, that they have unpacked that racism, and that they understand their whiteness and privilege and how that impacts on not just Aboriginal people, but people of other colour and of other cultures in this country. And so then we wouldn't have the disgusting, for example, policy of Rudd and, you know, stopping refugees coming in this country. So address racism, because I think that will make a huge issue individually for people and also structurally for Aboriginal people. I'd say it has to be blow up on the prisons, I
suppose.
Yeah. I think I'd be the attention of one, but I think you get to be loose.
I would just say, lest you think that these sorts of things aren't possible, and we've had some examples in Canada that, so I would give you a pretty bad news story, which is not great, examples where prisons have not been available for war segregation units, for instance, haven't been made available. It's amazing how quickly people can come up with alternatives, and in the midst, all the heads of corrections in our country, so not Yasmin's, like corrections, came up with recommendations that they could release at that time 75% of the jail population. Men, when yet it was immediately buried because it was not seen as a popular thing. And later then, in fact, changed the youth legislation because the judges had to first consider why they had not looked to the child welfare. Just that change alone had the number of young people in custody in our country. Now, it only went down by a third for with girls and for Indigenous children. There are examples that we can point to, and we can look to Stewart very viscerally, obviously, very real, because of his own experience, to jail a mother was to sentence generations to come. In the 70s was the head of juvenile corrections in the state of Massachusetts. All the young people, mostly boys, and he says that the mistake he made was not to ensure those resources. Tons of examples, I mean, I shouldn't say tons, but there are examples of where we've seen those options used and not seen an increase in this public safety. They tend not to be public safety.
And one last quick question.
Hi, my name's Sam. I'm a law student. It's sort of building on what you've been saying. I first became aware of the problems with imprisonment when I found a sex jail. The concept of total abolition of prisons is new to me tonight. Is there sort of in merit the argument that some people who commit crimes are so violent that they need to be separated from society for sex? Or can we abolish prisons entirely?
I believe we can abolish prisons entirely. And as abolitionists, we would all say that those that are violent towards others do need to be removed from the community, but not actually put into prison because that's a violent environment. So whether it be that person that you're talking about needs to be put somewhere in a community where 10 people are actually living in the same place and they're actually monitored in a way that they can't perpetrate violence against anybody else in the community. There's other ways, and I think we need to think outside the bars. Because around abolition, a lot of people ask the question, what do we replace it with? And it's actually not one thing, it's many things. And what we talk about in the abolition movement is decarceration strategies. So how do we incarcerate and let people out? So a man who spoke last night, I can't remember, was it 93,000 people had... What was that data last night about today? It was Australia with a pen. We could pretty well release a high majority of people in prison, you know, if it was a health issue, not a criminalisation issue. So that's what sort of the issue is. And so we need to look at who we're criminalising, and we're not necessarily criminalising only violent murderers and rapists. The majority of prison population is made up of poor Aboriginal women, predominantly, and men and young people who have experienced horrendous violence perpetrated against them, sexual abuse, physical abuse, family violence, drug addictions, mental health issues. That's who's targeted to be in prison. And we could, as I said, we can release those people to be in the community and we would be very safe. But we're not saying that those that are violent shouldn't be removed. Yes, they should be removed, but not to a prison environment, which is a violent environment, which actually then they come out of prison eventually more violent.
So there could be a range of options. In one of the things we do in, we try to go to the communities that are seen as the most resistant and sit down and say, okay, in your community, how many people are in prison, what are they, and what would they rather see happen? You know, most people, as a knee-jerk and started this work, I was a working class kid, it was all, yeah, it was going into prisons and not seeing really any redeeming. I'm prepared to live with hypocrisy, that there are people who we have treated so badly, that had such experiences that they have committed monstrous acts, prepared to live, as I think Deb has just said, with hypocrisy of my own position, that for a period of time we might not be able to see some options. But I think if we truly did start investing in individuals from day dot, no child should ever be raised without adequate accommodation, health care, and education, we would see a vastly different, so that's why I started by talking about Louis Arbour, see a vastly different environment than the one we do, if we didn't norm punishment and imprisonment. Mm-hmm. So even think of things like crime prevention. Why do we talk about crime prevention? But crime prevention, we're actually sending the message that when we're doing these, you know, crime prevention projects, feeding children in schools, recreation activities, what we're really saying is we're doing it. It sets up a mindset, which as you discussed in terms of some countries, is not even within their ken. They start in the notion that we should have universal entitlement to certain things, and not that we should be taking an approach that presumes. But it's not, as Deb said, it's not any one thing. But I think even the individuals who are, for instance, we go through and deconstruct the four men who are seen as having committed the most monstrous acts in our country, and say, you know, how did it start? All of them experienced issues within the very system that was supposed to be correcting them, and then try to deconstruct it and say, you know, not that that excuses anything that happens, but that if we in fact employed people to round the clock monitor those individuals so they could never harm someone again, that would both be economically, humanly, much more effective than what we're doing in terms of locking people away and perpetuating the notion that somehow punishment is going to solve it, or they're going to.
Okay, we're a few minutes over. I'm going to have to stop here, I'm sorry. But we can keep, I'm sure people will have more and more questions. We have gone a bit late, but I'm glad I took that last question because the reality was quite depressing, but we've actually finished with a bit of potential. So I ask you to take that potential with you and do all you can to create a reality from that potential. Thank you all for coming tonight. These events obviously are worth nothing without you, and I'd like you to join me thanking our speakers too.